the ground. Bruno shoved one, then the other toward them across the bare wood landing. Face down, Sam ordered. Bruno complied. Oren stepped out next, hands up, with Colton using him as a shield, gun to his head. Nice and slow, Colton said, blood running down his shirt. They're yours, once I'm out the door. Can't let that happen, Sam said. Remy, finger on the trigger, took aim. Colton looked right at her as he jammed the gun against Oren's jaw. Risk losing your star witness? She squeezed. The shot grazed Colton's skull. He stumbled back, momentarily stunned as Oren pulled away, diving for the floor. Exposed, Colton looked at Remy, raising his gun. Sam fired twice, one to the gut, one to the head. Colton crumpled to the ground. While Remy covered him, her gun aimed at the other two men, Sam moved in, checking to see if he was dead. Show off, Remy said as he picked up Oren's gun, handing it to her, then picked up the other two weapons from the floor, placing them on the table out of reach as sirens blared out front. He nodded at his Smith & Wesson. We might want to tuck that away for now, in case any of those police are armed. She returned the gun to him. Bad time to mention we need to smooth out that trigger pull? I missed a perfectly good headshot. Or, Sam said, holstering his .38 before the police walked in, you knew we wanted to avoid an inquest over bringing firearms into the country. She looked at him and laughed. Chapter 83. Several days later. Remy read the text from Selma. Bad news, she said, as she and Sam sat in the garden at Peyton Manor. Selma and Laszlo have declared the journal a dead end. If there's some secret treasure, they can't figure it out. She looked around the peaceful garden and sighed. It'd be nice to know what happened to it before we leave, if only to keep anyone else from bothering the Peytons. Since Oliver intends to move the car to a museum, I don't think it'll be an issue. He looked at his watch. Nearly six. We better get ready for dinner. Oliver had decided that a celebratory dinner was in order, now that Uncle Albert was finally released from custody, and all the financial accounts were slowly being released, and life at Peyton Manor was returning to normal. Since the Dowager Cottage, where Albert usually dined in the evening, was far too small to accommodate everyone, they all gathered in the south dining hall of the manor house. Uncle Albert, Remy noticed, looked the picture of health, considering where he'd been ever since his arrest. He was talking animatedly to Oliver about the roses in the garden. Remy reached over, grasped Sam's hand under the table. Oliver seems much happier. With the weight lifted from his shoulders, it has to be a relief to have his uncle back. And to know that he won't have to sell the ghost after all. She smiled happily, watching everyone interact with ease, the stress of the last couple of weeks having faded. Trevor was the one that impressed her the most. For the first few days after his return to Peyton Manor, he'd been quiet, jumping at every little sound. Now, looking at him as he and Chad talked and laughed together, he seemed like any other 16-year-old. Chad was definitely having a positive influence on the boy, she thought. Trevor was telling Chad how his mum was always after him about being on the computer and not meeting any nice girls. Chad laughed, then leaned toward him conspiratorially. You think that's bad, Trev? My mom and aunt both go at me. Do you have to work on cars all day? He said in falsetto. Comb your hair. How are you going to get a girl looking like that? Suddenly aware he was being watched, he looked around the table, saw Allegra, and turned a shade of red when their eyes met. Clearing his throat, he looked back at Trevor. But you should always listen to your mum, right? Trevor looked down at his near-empty plate, his eyes sparkling. Right. A toast, Oliver said, lifting his wine glass, looking at Sam and Remy. I meant to do this at the start of dinner. A toast to the both of you, since we wouldn't all be gathered here without your help. I don't know how to thank you except to say, welcome to the family. That, Sam said, might be the best thank you ever. Oliver looked around the table. And, of course, the reason we're all gathered, to celebrate Uncle Albert's return. Albert lifted his water glass.
Not sure what all the fuss is about. Nice chaps at that place, but they wouldn't let me come home. I don't think I want to stay there again.
Mrs. Beckett smiled at Albert as she cleared off his empty plate.
I expect you'll be glad to sleep in your own bed tonight, now that this ghost business is finally settled.
Settled? How?
He asked her.
It was stolen, and now it's back.
The ghost?
Stolen? That car was cursed from the get-go.
His gaze landed on Sam.
Did I tell you that you look like Cousin Eunice?
You did, Sam said. Albert gave a firm nod.
She and my brother found that old car in a barn when they were about Trevor's age. One of the Peytons hid it there during the war. Cursed. Didn't want anyone else to get hurt.
Trevor sat up with interest. How do you know it was cursed, Uncle Albert?
Things started happening.
Don't remember what they were now. He seemed drawn to Sam, lingering on his face.
Cousin Eunice and my brother found that sheet music after they read the journal. No stopping them after that.
Stopping them from what? Sam asked.
Searching for the stolen treasure from the train.
Albert looked at Oliver this time, his rare lucidity holding.
Your father used to pretend he was that American detective from the journal.
Isaac Bell? Trevor asked.
The same. And Cousin Eunice was always miffed because she wanted to be the detective.
Remy turned with an amused expression toward Sam, whispering,
See? That is where you get your sense of adventure from.
Trevor's eyes were glued on Uncle Albert.
Did they ever find it?
Find what?
The treasure. From the train robbery.
No one has, though we all looked. Wasn't in the ghost. Wasn't anywhere. I expect Reginald buried it, expecting he'd be able to come back one day. That's what I would have done.
He looked around the table, his expression one of confusion.
Is it somebody's birthday?
Oliver smiled. We're celebrating your return home.
Are we? I dare say it'll be a long time before I decide to stay in a hostel again. Ghastly place. Not sure it's worth celebrating.
Mrs. Beckett, hovering nearby, walked over, putting her hand on his shoulder.
It's getting late. How about we pop over to the cottage for some lemon ice?
Jolly good idea,
Albert said, standing. He cocked his head toward the table.
They're not all coming, are they?
No, my lord, she said.
We've talked about this my lord thing, haven't we?
He asked as she led him from the room.
Yes, my lord.
Thought so.
Oliver watched them until they disappeared through the doors.
Well,
at least we know he didn't seem to suffer any lasting damage from his incarceration. Allegra stared down at her plate, clearly weighed down by her guilt. Trevor, however, didn't seem to notice.
I think Uncle Albert's wrong about Reginald burying that treasure.
Everyone turned toward him at once, Oliver asking, Why do you say that?
Because of the journal.
Trevor seemed hesitant to continue.
What I remember of the last entry and what Reginald said about Peyton.
The lad has a remarkable memory,
Oliver explained, like Remy's.
Look at something once and it's imprinted in his brain.
Sam glanced at Remy.
You read it?
What do you think?
Sorry, Fargo. The farthest I read was when Peyton, Miss Atwater, and Isaac Bell were coming up with a plan to find out who hired Reginald Oren to steal the Grey Ghost.
Almost at once, they turned toward Trevor. Allegra nodded at him.
Go ahead, Trev. Tell them what happened.
Chapter 84 Journal of Jonathan Peyton, 5th Viscount Welswick, 1906 I noted the time on my gold pocket watch, precisely 11 p.m., before settling back in my seat, ignoring my cousin, who was slumped on the floorboards of the coach, hands tied, mouth gagged, barely stirring the entire time, perhaps because of the laudanum we'd dosed him with. Byron drove the coach, while Mr. Bell stood on the footman's platform, and Miss Atwater sat across from me, a determined expression on her face. I looked down at my cousin, half tempted to cosh him on the head over the trouble he'd caused. But Mr. Bell said we might find use for him before the night was through. And so I resisted. When the coach slowed and I felt Isaac Bell jump off the back, I pulled the curtain far enough to see out, watching as he walked off, stirring the tendrils of fog that snaked out across the cobblestones. The vehicle lurched forward, the steady clip-clop of the horse's hooves picking up speed. We neared the tavern where I'd found myself earlier that night, but then continued on, stopping farther up the road in the shadows to watch and wait. I looked down at Reggie, whom eventually we'd be turning over to the police. Our goal this night, however, was to find the buyer, the one who set out to ruin Rolls-Royce and bankrupt the investors. The only bit of information Mr. Bell had managed to wrest from my cousin was the name of a man who was acting as a liaison between him and the buyer. That, Bell said, was all that he needed. When the carriage came to a stop, I again pulled the curtain to peer out, seeing that the fog had thickened considerably in the few minutes it had taken us to circle around. I searched for Mr. Bell and saw him lingering beneath a gas street lamp, the flickering light reflecting off the gray mist around him. A moment later, he stepped inside the tavern, looking for the man that Reggie had said was waiting there to buy the Gray Ghost. My cousin began to stir as the laudanum wore off, and I reached down, lifted his head so that I could see his face. "You're awake," I said. Reggie's eyes opened, then widened as he saw me watching him. He tried screaming through the gag tied around his mouth as he struggled to free himself from the ropes around his wrists and feet. When that failed, he kicked at the coach door. As Miss Atwater scooted to the other side, I brought the heel of my boot down on his shins. "Do that again, and you'll regret it." He tried speaking through the gag. I dug my heel in harder. "Do not test my patience." I leveled my sternest look on him. "A word of warning, cousin. You make a noise loud enough to be heard by anyone other than me, I'll kick your teeth out." "Do you understand?" I asked, enunciating each word clearly. For the first time ever, I saw fright in Reggie's eyes. I hated resorting to violence, but Mr. Bell's life depended on my cousin's silence. Bell told us that if the man in the tavern suspected anything was amiss, if he suspected Isaac at all, he'd likely try to kill him. I refused to have anyone's death on my conscience, especially Mr. Bell's. Not that I was worried the man couldn't handle himself. After all, he'd single-handedly taken down both Reggie and his accomplices, and recovered the stolen Gray Ghost in the process. What we hadn't recovered was the stolen treasure, but Mr. Bell assured us that it was only a matter of time. I looked out the window, saw Isaac Bell stepping out of the tavern, looking very much like the dandy he was trying to portray. A swarthy, dark-haired man followed him out, and the pair walked in our direction. When they reached the coach, Isaac rapped on the door, calling out, "Apparently this man is under orders that he's only to deal with Mr. Reginald Oren. They're insisting on seeing him. Now." Miss Atwater and I exchanged glances. She lifted her hand, as though holding a glass to her lips. She was as brilliant as she was beautiful. I realized, though, that to allay a suspicion, such news of Reginald's intoxication would sound better coming from a woman. I leaned toward her, whispering that she should respond. She hesitated but a second before leaning toward the window and pulling the curtain open just enough for the pair outside to see only her. "He's had a bit much to drink, but I'll see if I can't rouse him." "Thank you," Mr. Bell said. He stepped back from the coach, giving a bland smile. The other man looked in the window, trying to see, but she closed the curtain. "This better not be some trick," he said. "I assure you, it's not," Isaac said. Using my father's dagger, I leaned in close to Reggie, whispering a reminder about the loss of his teeth if he so much as uttered something I didn't like. I pulled down his gag and dragged him up, hoping the man outside didn't notice the odd rocking of the coach as I forced my cousin to the window, whispering, "Be careful." Miss Atwater pulled the curtain for him to look out. "What?" Reggie barked. The man shifted on his feet as he peered into the window. "Mr. Keene said you were the only one we were to talk to. No one else." When Reggie said nothing, I pressed the point of my father's dagger into his spine. "So here I am," Reggie said. "Now make the sale." "You're sure?" "You heard me. I'm here now. You want the 40-50? Tell Keene to bring the money." "This wasn't how you said it would—" I pressed harder. Reggie's shoulder jerked toward the window. "Tell Mr. Keene to bring the money to my uncle's warehouse," he said through gritted teeth. I poked him again. "And to hurry, before I change my mind." The man narrowed his eyes as though not quite trusting what he was hearing. After a moment, he shrugged, looking at Isaac. "I'll be off then." After he left, I wanted to follow, but Isaac bade me wait. "Why?" I asked. "He'll lead us right to this Mr. Keene." "Barclay Keene?" Miss Atwater said. "And who would that be?" Belle asked. "The man who owns the Barclay Keene Electric Motor Works," she replied. "He's married to the sister of the headmaster at the orphanage. I've heard tell the business is struggling financially." "Interesting," Belle said. "Perhaps where some of that money embezzled from the orphanage is ending up." It made perfect sense to me. What I didn't understand was why weren't we immediately going after Keene to make an arrest? And so I asked Mr. Bell. "Because we only have the word of your cousin, an admitted thief and murderer. Not much good against that of a prominent businessman, wouldn't you say? My feeling is, the more evidence against Keene, the better."
"But there's our good word," I said, "and that of Miss Atwater."
Miss Atwater reached out, placing her gloved hand on my arm.
"What is it you suggest, Mr. Bell?"
she asked. "We wait at the warehouse for this Barclay Keene to bring the money. He can hardly deny his involvement then, can he?" Though it was a tense hour waiting in the cold warehouse, Miss Atwater and I hid in the shadows, along with two constables, whom Mr. Bell had called in. Finally, Mr. Keene and his man arrived. Byron, still playing Reggie's coach driver, met them at the warehouse door, and the two men walked in, Keene's eye on the gray ghost, which we'd parked inside.
"Nicely done," Keene said,
trying to hand his satchel of money to Reggie, who was seated in a chair, with Mr. Bell standing right behind him. Keene apparently failed to realize that something was amiss until he noticed Reggie wasn't reaching out to take it. He couldn't. His hands were tied behind his back, though that detail was concealed by the cloak Mr. Bell had put over my cousin's shoulders.
"What on earth?" Keene said.
Reggie gave him a cynical smile. "I have some bad news, Keene." The older man frowned, not understanding until the two constables stepped into the light, surrounding him. The man from the tavern drew a dagger, lunging at one of the constables, but Isaac Bell was quicker. He tackled the younger man, and the blade clattered to the floor. I stepped forward to help, but Keene drew a pistol. I stopped as he fired, the bullet so close that I felt my cloak move as it passed. Had he not hesitated before taking a second shot, distracted by Bell calling my name, I'd be dead. I knew instinctively what Bell wanted. I tossed my father's cane. It barely hit Bell's hand, the shaft almost a blur as he swung it toward Keene, knocking the pistol from his grasp, then bringing it upward in one fluid motion, striking Keene's jaw with the brass handle. As Keene stumbled, Bell recovered the man's gun, aiming it at him. "I believe our work is done here," he said, when Miss Atwater cried out. We all turned to see Reggie slumping to the floor, shot by Keene's pistol. I rushed to his side, kneeling.
"Reggie."
His face ashen, he looked at me, asking for his wife.
"Of course," I said, looking around for help. "Let's get help first."
But Mr. Bell,
seeing the growing stain on Reggie's torso, shook his head. "Bring her here," he said quietly, as he folded Reggie's cloak and pressed it to the wound. "Byron," I said, "would you?" My friend nodded, ran from the building. Mr. Bell and I laid Reggie on the floor, while Miss Atwater took her own cloak, fashioning a pillow for Reggie. I was at once amazed by her fortitude, as well as by her forgiveness of the man who'd kidnapped her. After several minutes, his breathing grew shallow, and we knew his time with us was nearing an end. "The treasure, man," Mr. Bell said, patting him on the cheek to rouse him. "Where is it?"
"My wife. Where?"
"On her way," I said.
"Tell her. The music. Give it to her. Would you, cousin?"
"What music?" Bell said. I saw sheets of music in the chest with the car parts. "Miss Atwater," I said, "would you mind?" She stood, her gaze lingering on Bell's bloody hand as he pressed the cloak to Reggie's stomach. Looking away, she hurried to the chest on the floor beside the gray ghost, lifted the lid, and pulled out several sheets of music. She carried them over to us. "This?" she asked him. He opened his eyes.
"She wanted to learn."
"Save your strength," I said, seeing what an effort it was for him to speak. "She'll be here." "The treasure?" Bell asked again. "Tell us." And just when I thought he'd left us, he looked right at me.
"You helped."
"Helped what?" I asked. But it was too late. He was gone. Keane denied knowing anything of the treasure or the train robbery. He was in it only to ruin Rolls-Royce. The saddest part that night was having to tell Reggie's wife, Elizabeth, of all that had transpired once she'd arrived. Her stoic expression as she listened nearly broke me. A tear slipped down her cheek.
"Where is he?"
We stood aside. Her breath caught. She walked over, looked down at him, sank to her knees, and called him a fool.
"Why?"
Her ragged whisper tore through me. I put my hand on her shoulder, but she pushed me away, then started out. Miss Atwater held out the sheets of music to her. "Your husband wanted you to have these," she said. Elizabeth took the music, looked over each page in disgust, tossed it all into the gray ghost. "Music won't feed my child," she said. "Mrs. Oren," Isaac Bell called out as she started to walk off, "I'm very sorry for your loss, but if you know where the stolen money is, if my husband took any money, he failed to tell me about it. So please, allow me to take my leave. I need to return to my son." And though I insisted she was welcome to stay at Peyton Manor, she refused. I fear she blamed me for her husband's death. Perhaps she was right. The next day, she took her son and left, with naught but the clothes they wore. For weeks after, we searched the Grey Ghost, the warehouse, and Peyton Manor, thinking that $500,000 would be difficult to hide. But we never located any sign of the missing money. And this, despite Mr. Bell's assurances, his last words to us being, "You'll find it." Chapter 85. The five of them listened, transfixed, as Trevor related what he recalled from the last journal entry. "No doubt about it," Sam said. "The sheet music is the clue. Maybe the notes are a code. Has anyone ever really looked at it since it was found?" "The music?" Oliver asked. "I wouldn't even know the first place to look. We could try to ask Uncle Albert. I'm just not sure it would do any..." "I say, Fargo, didn't Uncle Albert say something about your mother and my father finding the music back when?" "He did at that." Sam checked the time, took out his phone, and called his mother. He turned it on speaker so that everyone could hear. "Sam, is everything okay? How's Albert?" "He's fine. Everyone's fine," he said.
His mother had been upset with him for waiting so long to tell her about everything that had happened, until he'd explained about the hacking. He'd insisted that he would have called her earlier, except he was worried that she'd end up getting hacked, too. He wasn't sure if she believed him and started right in with the question, hoping she wouldn't think to belabor the point. Albert was telling us about how you and his brother found the sheet music in the Grey Ghost that was mentioned in the journal.
Sheet music?
Several seconds ticked by. Then she laughed. That was so long ago, I'd almost forgotten. We used to play detectives. Something about a treasure we were going to find, and the music was a clue. Do you know where it is?
The treasure?
The music. She laughed again. It was falling apart when we found it all those years ago. Well, I expect it ended up in the trash at some point. Did you get a good look at it?
Decades ago?
Hold on. She must have muted the call as it went silent. A few seconds later, she was back on the line. Just saying goodbye to my afternoon charter. Now, what is it you're hoping I saw?
Anything.
Something written on it. Notes circled.
If there was, it had faded by the time we found it.
She started humming a somewhat off-key but familiar tune. Come away with me, Lucille. In my merry Oldsmobile? Sam and Remy asked together.
That's the song, she said.
They heard a muffled noise, as though she were covering over the receiver. A moment later, she was back. Hate to cut it short, but I need to return to my guests. Thanks, Mom. Sam smiled at Remy. Reggie's version of a message in a bottle to his wife?
Except the car's been searched, she said.
Many times, Oliver added. Maybe someone knew about the music. After all, there were several people in and out of the warehouse that night. Byron? The night watchman? Maybe one of them went back.
I don't buy it, Sam said. As good a detective as this Isaac Bell was, I'd have to think searching the ghost for the missing treasure was the first thing he did.
Oliver tried for a cheerful smile. Doesn't really matter now, does it? We're all safe, and that's what counts. Trevor looked crestfallen as he turned toward Remy.
You read the journal?
Reggie told Jonathan twice.
You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Remy locked eyes with the boy. Sam knew how her brain worked. She was mentally ticking off the facts she'd read with a speed that always amazed him. Suddenly, she smiled, then looked at Sam. That music was a message to his wife. After all, Reggie specifically requested that it be given to her. And if you recall, when Peyton told him to think about his wife and child before he did something he'd regret, Reggie specifically said that's exactly whom he was thinking of.
He knew the risks, Sam said.
Maybe preparing for the eventuality he might not come back and sending her a message in case something happened to him.
Maybe, Remy said, looking up something on her phone.
Another possibility is that Reggie was trying to make things right at the end.
How? Oliver asked her.
With his dying declaration.
Trevor's correct, she said, earning a smile from the boy. He'd told Peyton not once but twice that Peyton had helped him move the treasure.
Admittedly, the first time it was more of a taunt, right after he'd been captured by Bell.
But the second time was after he'd been shot, and he specifically told them to give the music to his wife.
Remy's attention was suddenly drawn to something on her phone's screen.
It makes sense, Oliver said. We know Isaac Bell was desperately trying to get him to say where he'd hidden the treasure before he died. And we know Reggie's last words to Peyton were, "You helped."
Still, was the answer in the journal or not?
I think it is, Remy said.
Sam recognized that look in her eyes. There was no think about it. She knew what the answer was, and held up her phone, showing them a photo of the sheet music from the internet. That song was very popular in 1905 and early 06. She glanced at Sam.
Maybe a bit of that British irony when you think about it.
You mean he picked the song for the car reference, but not because he hid the treasure in the car? Her cat-like smile was all the answer Sam needed. Remy knew exactly where that treasure was. Chapter 86 Sam sat back and watched as Remy and Trevor discussed what was in the journal, the others looking on. As their discussion progressed, he could see the boy's confidence growing as she subtly guided him, allowing him to see what she saw without ever giving away that she even knew the answer. After a few more minutes of back and forth between the two, Remy nodded thoughtfully. I wonder if any of this has something to do with Miss Atwater. Maybe, Trevor said, his gaze fixed on his water glass, lost in thought. Suddenly, his eyes widened, and he shot out of his seat, looking over at his mother, then Remy. It was all about the music. He ran toward the door, his demeanor one of pure excitement. The others hesitated, not quite sure what to think, but just as quickly they hurried after him through the garden to the Dowager cottage, Sam and Remy bringing up the rear. Trevor banged on the door. Finally, Mrs. Beckett opened it. We need to see Uncle Albert, he said, darting past her. It's important. Albert stepped into the parlor a moment later as they all filed in after Trevor. What's all this? Didn't know we were having guests, Mrs. Beckett.
Neither did I.
Trevor walked over to the pianoforte, pulling out the bench, taking a seat, lifting the cover from the keys. Miss Atwater sat right here, next to Peyton. He hit one of the bass keys, then another, and another, each making a plunking noise.
She told him it needed tuning.
Sam and Remy stood back as Oliver and Chad lifted off the top of the piano so that they could see inside. Oliver told Trevor to do the honor of looking in, handing him his cell phone to use as a flashlight. Trevor hesitated, glancing shyly at Remy. She smiled at him, and he turned on the light, shining it into the depths of the piano. He looked back at her, then his mother, his face filled with wonder.
There's something down there. Mum, you have to see this.
He handed her the phone. When she and Oliver moved in, Trevor looked over at Remy.
You were right, Mrs. Fargo.
Me? You're the one who found it. I was thinking of the piano bench. That's where you keep music, isn't it?
Sam put his arm around Remy's shoulders. Sure it is, he whispered as Oliver and Chad searched for the clips to remove the front of the piano. The antique bench didn't have storage for music, and he doubted his wife would have forgotten that fact from their visit that first night at Peyton Manor.
Here now, Albert said, marching over to the piano as Oliver and Chad removed the front cover. What are you doing there?
Have a look, Uncle Albert, Oliver said.
He peered in, saw something, harrumphed, shaking his head as he returned to the dining room to finish his lemon ice.
No wonder that thing never sounded right.
They fished out a single leather satchel from the depths, and Oliver carried it to the table.
Open it, Trevor said, excited.
Oliver opened it. There were a handful of gold sovereigns shimmering in the lamplight, along with a much larger rectangular flat item wrapped in oilcloth. Sam read the date on one of the sovereigns, 1905. Talk about mint condition. Considering the price of gold, I'll bet they're worth close to 300 times their face value.
Hardly the half million in gold still missing, Oliver said.
Trevor moved in for a closer look.
Do we get to keep any of it?
Sorry, lad,
Oliver said. Stolen, which means it all goes back to the crown. He lifted a corner of the oilcloth, his brows going up. He looked at Remy.
What was it you were saying about British irony earlier in the evening?
He removed the cloth entirely, showing them stacks upon stacks of white 100-pound notes from the Bank of England, as well as the engraving plates.
I dare say, this might be the king of irony.
Why? Trevor asked. That's the missing money, isn't it? Half a million?
Worthless, Oliver said, nodding at the stacks of money.
Since 1945.
He gave a deep sigh.
This might have all been avoided had the journal specified the money stolen was banknotes instead of gold sovereigns.
It was late by the time Sam and Remy made it to bed. Remy snuggled in close next to Sam.
Not quite the hall we thought,
Still, quite the find. Just thinking about what might have happened if those plates made it into Reggie Oren's hands, had Isaac Bell not stopped him, boggles the mind. I'll bet those stolen engraving plates are why they decided to hire someone with Isaac Bell's expertise. She scooted up onto her elbows and kissed him. Job well done, Fargo. I do have one question, Rennie. How'd you figure out the money was hidden in the piano? The piano was the only thing that Peyton had hoped Reggie move. Brilliant and beautiful. Chapter 87. A year after Sam and Remy returned to their home on the cliffs above the restless surf, they were enjoying a late breakfast when a semi-truck and trailer pulled up and stopped in front of their driveway. A few minutes later, Selma and the driver came out on the balcony. Selma did not look happy.
Mr. and Mrs. Fargo, this fellow claims he has a large shipment that is scheduled to be delivered to this address. I told him he was crazy, but he has a bill of lading with your name on it.
Remy laughed and said, obviously a mistake. Sam quickly interrupted. Oh, I think I might have failed to mention. Sam, you failed to mention what? It's your birthday present, Sam said, with a big smile on his face. Remy began to smell a rat. You know very well my birthday is in April, not July. The driver shrugged and said, sorry, folks, I have no choice but to unload the shipment here.
Yes, let's take a look at it, said Remy.
I can't wait to see what it is. The driver entered the trailer, banging and clanging around. He lowered a ramp and stepped out with a small electronic transmitter. A motor tautened the cable as the shipment began to move from the darkened interior of the trailer. When something big and red made its appearance, Remy broke into unrestrained laughter. It took a year to give it a first-rate restoration. But she's a beauty, Sam said. Selma and Laszlo stood in awe, seeing the 1917 Aaron's Fox fire engine gleaming under a bright sun. The front repair of the Stirling valves and silver pump were touched up with chrome and nickel plating, creating a blinding reflection. The original red paint and beautiful gold-leafed decorations were buffed to a shiny patina. Sam lightly rubbed his hand over a fender as if it was a shrine. They were able to save the ladders, hoses, and the wooden wheels. It's still all original. Just think. 100 years old, said Sam, and ready to put out a fire.
It looks like new, said Remy, as she admired the golden trim. I can't believe it's the same vehicle we crashed through those iron doors with. How did you get it looking so new?
I hired a company in London who are experts at restoring vehicles, answered Sam. I think you'll agree, they did a flawless job. After writing a check to satisfy the truck driver, Sam and Laszlo disappeared and returned with a battery and a jerry jug of fuel. Everyone ready, Sam called out as he helped Remy and Selma on board. Even Zoltan jumped onto the floorboard next to Remy.
He's not a Dalmatian, but he'll have to do, said Remy.
Then with Sam at the wheel, Laszlo ringing the bell, Remy leaning on the siren and Zoltan howling, the Aaron's Fox flew through the streets of La Jolla like a dragon from the past. This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Gray Ghost by Clive Cussler and Robin Bursell. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn, executive producer Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2017 by Sandecker RLLLP. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.